You're listening to Bit by Bit, July 13th, 2005. Hello and welcome. My name is Bob Sprankle and this is Bit by Bit, a podcast by a teacher for teachers, talking and reflecting about the use of technology in instruction and the changing classroom environment in the 21st century. Today I got a real special treat. As promised in my last episode, this is a speech that was given by former Maine Governor Angus King to a group of SEED members. And what SEED is an organization that I used to belong to before it ended in the spring, called SEED, which stands for Spreading Educator to Educator Development. And what SEED was all about was using technology to achieve Maine's learning results through teachers teaching teachers. It was a 6-year grant that just ended in the spring, and I'll put a link to the website. You can learn more about SEED. And go there because there are excellent resources and numerous developer packages that are all aligned to the Maine's learning result. Excellent stuff. So here's Angus King with a real wake-up call. I left this talk happy and a little bit scared and depressed that SEED was ending, but it was just such a fantastic talk. I mean, he kind of puts the fear of God into you about how our classrooms have to change to meet this new world that we are in. And he mentions the book by Friedman, The World is Flat. I have mine on order. I've been meaning to get to this since this talk, and I finally have ordered it. I can't wait to read it. But Friedman, you've probably heard of that book, just talking about how we are living on a level playing field with the world now, and we've got to get our kids ready. And Angus King says there's two ways that are going to save us, and that is education and technology with that. This show is going to break out of the normal format of just sticking to 10 minutes. I think we're about 35 minutes long. So here it is. It's a special treat. Governor King let me podcast this for a future date, and I thank him, and I hope you enjoy.
Boy, talk about feeling like you're among friends. I have to tell you, you're my people, I got to tell you. When I was starting to run for a second term, you have to get petition signatures. We had to get 7,000 petition signatures. And Mary and I had planned to go to New York for the weekend, and Kay said, "You go to New York, we'll get the signatures." So we went away, and I'll never forget calling her from a cell phone in a store in New York at the end, like, you know, 6 o'clock Saturday evening. "How did it go?" And Kay said, "It went great. We got the signatures, no problem." And she said, "I now know who your people are." And I said, with some trepidation, "Oh, who are they?" She said, "Women over 60 and large men in black T-shirts." Isn't that? I thought that was a great line. So you guys aren't in either of those categories, but you're certainly qualified. Well, I don't know quite where to start. I'm going to give you a little bit of background. Yesterday, I was in State College, Pennsylvania, speaking to a one-to-one conference in Western Pennsylvania, where all kinds of things are happening in districts, schools, counties. They are very excited about one-to-one down there. I'm going back next Monday to Philadelphia to talk to a middle school group there. And then 2 weeks later, I'm going to the Eastern Shore of Maryland to talk about one-to-one to a small school district down there. I've been to Australia to a one-to-one conference. Just this morning, I had seven English guys in my living room in Brunswick talking about one-to-one. This is huge. And the really neat thing is, it's all about Maine. This is known as the Maine Plan. I'm a saint down there in Pennsylvania. You know, and it really proves the old saying that a prophet is always without honor in his without honor in his own country. You know, it's really funny because we're struggling to keep it alive and legislators are trying to take the funding and everything and how do we do it? And everybody else is trying to do what we did. I must say it does create a sort of an odd feeling. I won't go through the whole thing about why we did it, although I'm certainly going to share some of that. But I will say this, and I've really just come to this in the past week or so. When this was first proposed in 2000, and I'll give you some background on where the idea came from, the MLTI, we knew it was a big idea. This was a big idea. When it started to be implemented over the last two or three years, and I started to think more and talk to a lot of teachers and educators about it, I realized it was a radical idea. This is real change. This is not just little incremental change and, you know, having five periods instead of four or something. This is a radical change. I now believe that it's a necessary idea. I am more passionate about this today than I was 5 years ago. Through some luck and circumstances and events coming together, we stumbled on to the right idea at the right time. And we have to continue it, and we have to figure out how to continue it. We have to figure out how to institutionalize it and keep it going. My successor has been very supportive. He's had pressure to, you know, defund it and things like that. He's stood up to that. But we have to keep pushing in order to keep it going. It would be tragic if at the very time the rest of the world was climbing on the bandwagon, Maine fell off. I mean, it would just be tragic because we are doing it better and on a more extensive scale than anybody else in the world. I mean, people are literally coming from all over the world. I had 25 Australians at my house 2 weeks ago. By the way, Australians really do say g'day mate. And the guy at the end of our talking together, the guy took his tie off and it had kangaroos on it. He gave it to me. He said, "I want to give you a kangaroo tie." Said, "Australia is the only country in the world that eats its national animal." And sure enough, when I was in Australia, I went to a restaurant in Melbourne and I had to order kangaroo. And, you know, I was a little squeamish about it, but I sort of got over it. It tastes, I don't know, sort of like deer or something. But then it sort of threw me when the waitress came up and said, "So how was Skippy?" Anyway, let me tell you why this is so important. Within the next 48 hours, get this book. It is called The World is Flat by Thomas L. Friedman. It just came out about a month ago. Tom Friedman is the foreign affairs correspondent for the New York Times. This, I think, is the most important book published in the United States in the last 10 years. And what he does is trace all the threads that have come together to what he calls flatten the earth, which essentially means level the playing field and put us in competition with the rest of the world. For the last 60 years, America has largely had a free ride. Europe was devastated by World War II, Japan was devastated by World War II, and America, Japan, and Europe were the economic world. And China was asleep. Our generation should build a statue. We should all chip in to build a giant statue of Mao Zedong in Washington because he kept the Chinese off the world playing field for, you know, 50 years. And we're the beneficiaries of that because we didn't have to cope with China. That's no longer the case. India was a socialist country for the last 50 years and their economy was not going anywhere and was not competitive. All of a sudden, and Friedman calls, he has 10 flatteners, things that have flattened the world. The idea is a level playing field. Think of us as a big, very successful football team in the middle of a playing field, but we've won all of our games for 50 years. We haven't had any serious competition. And what would happen to that team? It would get overweight, out of condition, kind of sloppy, and not very well trained. All of a sudden, there are new teams coming onto the field that are hungry and aggressive and ambitious. And this book will scare you to death. Essentially, Friedman says that every job in the United States that can be digitized or done in a labor that requires labor is vulnerable. Every job. Radiology. They're now reading x-rays at night in India. Call centers. I don't have to tell you about call centers. The other night I called DirecTV 1-800. Wonderful conversation. Guy answered the phone and he looked at the record and said, "Oh, Angus, how are you?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "You're in Brunswick, right?" I said, "Yeah, Brunswick." He said, "Yeah, well, what's wrong with the DirecTV?" And we walked through this thing. It was over. And he said, "Well, Angus, is there anything more I can do with you?" I said, "For you?" I said, "No, I just have one question. Where are you?" He said, "New Delhi." They have classes in New Delhi teaching Indians to speak with Midwest accents. I always thought call centers were safe because, you know, you needed to be American. They're teaching them. Tom Friedman went to a class where they asked him to teach them how Minnesotans talked. So when you call, you know, when you call a call center and somebody says Minnesota, you know, that's an Indian. Let's learn how to say that. And I wrote a piece on this just a week ago, and I said the only jobs that aren't subject to being exported are jobs where you touch the customer physically or something that they own. That leaves chiropractors and plumbers. You know. Now, that's what I wrote a week ago. Two nights ago on 60 Minutes was a story about people flying to India to have heart transplants and hip transplants at 1/10 the cost of doing it at Maine Medical Center with the same level of care. In other words, in the U.S., it costs $150,000 to do a hip transplant. You can go to India, have your hip transplant, take your family with you, stay in a first-class hotel, tour India when it's over, and come back $100,000 ahead. Wow. Think of that. And you see, the fiber optic stuff, which we all built in the late 20th century, we overbuilt, has eliminated distance. It's free to talk to India. There's no cost. You can now drive through. There's a guy that owns a series of McDonald's franchises in Missouri. And you drive in to get, you know, and the little voice on the microphone says, you know, what can we get for you tonight? And you say, you know, two Big Macs and fries. And he says, you want big fries or little fries? You know, I want big fries and a chocolate shake. And you drive to this, okay, that'll be $6.99, drive to the window. That guy is in Denver. And the cook is in the McDonald's, but he's taking your order. And that could just as easily be in India, because it's free, call, and take in the order. Now, when we're outsourcing fast food jobs, folks, what's left? Now, I just finished this afternoon Friedman's chapter on what we do about it. Guess what? Guess what is the only hope? Education. Education is the only chance. We're not going to compete on wages. There are 3 billion people in China and India. Every job in America tomorrow could move to China and they would still have a labor surplus. Think of that. It's unbelievable. So we're not going to compete on wages. Natural resources can move anywhere in the world. Information can move anywhere in the world. Anything can be digitized. Do your taxes, you go to your accountant. A lot of accountants are hiring people in India to do the taxes. You know, you go to Brunswick and give them the data, and you don't know it, but overnight it's going to India. So that's where a lot of the accounting work is being done. Back office operations, Maine is really vulnerable to this. Our financial services that we, you know, feel so good about that I worked hard to recruit, they can go instantly. This is not entirely new in human history. This has been happening throughout human history. It's happened throughout the history of Maine. You drive around Maine, you go to Biddeford, Lewiston, Brunswick, and you see these big red brick mills, you know, the big red brick mills. They were all full of textile workers 7,500 years ago. Those jobs went. They went to North Carolina and South Carolina. By the way, it doesn't tear me up when the people in North Carolina complain about those jobs going to China, because they took them from us. But those jobs went. The shoe jobs went from Maine. What's different and scary about the current situation is how fast it's happening and how fast it can happen. I worked for Bill Hathaway in the U.S. Senate in 1973, and I remember because we did a lot of shoe stuff about Maine. And at that time, 1973, Maine had 30,000 people built making shoes. 30,000. Today we have about 1,500. So loss of jobs is nothing new. But it took 35 years to go from 30,000 to 1,500. We can go from 30,000 call center jobs to 1,500 in about 3 years. And if it takes 35 years, people can retire and transition and do other things. It's still hard. It's no treat when Bass Shoe closes. But it's over a period of time, and other jobs come in, and it's, you know, it sort of happens. But if when it happens overnight, it's really going to be devastating. And the only answer is education and technology. It's education and technology. All of this stuff involves technology. The only thing that we have, and I hate it when people read from books, so I'm not going to read from books, but the only thing that Americans have in the long run is innovation. And innovation comes from technology, from people who have the training and the expertise to use technology. And that's where, that sort of brings us back to MLTI. That brings us back to the laptop. Because the whole idea at the beginning of the laptop project, yes, it was important that they could be used for content. You can use it. It's a wonderful teaching tool. And that's the real heart of it. But in addition to that is an X factor. The X factor is the kids becoming totally comfortable with the technology itself. That it's an extension of their arm. It's how they solve problems. It's the first thing they think of to solve a problem, to work together, to collaborate, to communicate, to gather data, to manipulate data, to present data. And it's when those kids use this thing every day, all day, that then cool things are going to pop out. And you all know this better than I. You know, you'll have fourth graders doing amazing things. Seventh and eighth graders coming up with ideas. And then some kid in Dover, Foxcroft, or Fort Kent, or Portland is going to say, I wonder if we could make it do this. And that's when the next breakthrough comes. And that's why it would be so tragic for us to step back from this. Because we don't have time. There's an urgency here. If we don't get this thing right away, it's not like we've got 25 years to figure this out. We've got about 3 years to figure it out. Because if you think about it, a change made now in the seventh grade or the fifth grade in Maine isn't going to have an impact on the person's work life for 10 years. So we've got to do it now. Otherwise, 10 years from now, it's too late. I always remember taking driver's ed. Everybody remember driver's ed? And one of the things I remember, the one thing I remember from driver's ed is they taught us, one of the things you had to learn was, I remember on the driver's exam, if you're going 50 and you put on the brakes, how long will it take you to stop? Remember that? You had to remember those numbers, 272 feet and 146 feet and whatever it was. And then they told us how far your headlights would illuminate. And what we learned, what I'll never forget learning, was that if you're going above a certain speed, let's say you're going 50, and if you hit the brakes, it'll take you 175 feet to stop. And your headlights illuminate 200 feet. So you're okay. But there's a point, and I don't remember where it was, 60, 65, 70, where your headlights illuminate 200 feet, but it takes you 220 feet to stop. That means you can't avoid the wall. You're not going to see the wall until it's too late to stop. And that's sort of the situation we're in now. If we don't do something about this now, it's going to be too late, because we're already going to have hit the wall. We just don't know it yet. And that's why I think this is so important. The other thing that's so important about the way we did it here in Maine, and that is the marvel of other places, is that it's everybody. It's every 7th and 8th grader. It's every kid. And that's very important. And I think we've got to hold on to that. My concern is that if the state decides for budget reasons or whatever, and believe me, I'm the first person to be sympathetic with budget, I feel very sorry for John Baldacci. At least when I was in office, when the economy improved, the revenues improved, and we had a few years of surpluses. Remember that word, surplus? It means you got more money than you thought. I mean, you haven't had it in a long time. His problem is the economy improves, and at the very same time, Washington's pulling the pins out from under Medicaid or whatever it is. So you can never get ahead. You can't ever get out of the hole. It's very, very tough. And the last thing I'm going to do is push on that. But if this is turned into a block grant, you know, every school gets a little hunk of dough through GPA, it'll disappear. Some districts it'll be great. Other districts they'll use them for carts, and you know, it'll just sort of go into a black hole. I think that's a big mistake. I mean, one of the great powerful things about our initiative is that it's statewide. It's every kid, every town, every school, poor, rich, urban, rural. And we got to fight to maintain that. Because what we're doing is giving these kids a tool that they would never otherwise have. Many of them, in a way that they wouldn't otherwise have, and we're going to unlock talent that we doesn't even know it's there. You know, I have this dream that somewhere in Fort Kent or Phillips or Westbrook, there's the next Bill Gates, and I hope he adopts me when he grows. We've got to keep it in the hands of these kids, because if it turns into just, you know, the wealthier districts and the districts that have superintendents who have the vision, that's going to be a loss, and it's the kids that are going to be the losers on that. I can't pass this opportunity up. This thing is not going to keep going by itself, and I'm not in charge anymore. I can't put it on my back and carry it all by myself. I can be active and try to help and try to raise money and, you know, that kind of thing. But I'll be honest with you, one of the problems with this project was that it was too closely identified with me. And that made it have political baggage, because people who didn't like me didn't like the project. You see what I mean? And the legislature, this is a way to zap King, you know, and all that. It's got to have champions in the community. You've got to be the champions who talk to your legislators and say, hey, you can't let this go. This is fabulous what's going on. Come over to the school and see it. It drives me crazy, the number of legislators who've never come into the classroom. I'm against it. It's a terrible idea. They want to take you in. Go see it. No, I don't have time. Don't let them do that. Make them do it. Because my experience is, once they get into the classroom and see what's happening, that's the best argument we can make. I can talk till I'm blue in the face, and often do. But it's getting them into the classroom. But you've got to, and believe me, you can influence the legislature. The Maine legislature is so accessible. People say politicians are accessible. Nonsense. The Maine legislature is incredibly accessible. Five letters is a tidal wave. I'm not kidding. To a legislator. 10 letters, you know, that's it. You got it. And they really listen. And they really listen to stories. Tell them the stories of the kids in your districts, the kids you've worked with, the special ed kid who was in a shell and never communicated and didn't participate, and who suddenly the iBook has opened him up and allowed him to communicate and participate. I've gotten letters from parents that have just brought tears to my eyes like that. That's what moves people. And so you've got to take this on. If you think, well, King's going to take care of this, or John Baldacci's going to take care of it, it isn't going to happen. And frankly, I think we're at a crucial moment here. We're in the third year, the fourth year is next year, then it's over. The current contract is over, and the question is, what comes next spring? And that decision's going to be made between now and probably next February or so. And right now, if I had to bet, I'd bet that they're going to just sort of let it peter out. And I think that's a terrible, terrible, terrible waste of a golden opportunity. Because you know better than I that, in many ways, this is a ridiculous debate. Of course every child in America is going to have a digital device at his or her desk. Of course. I mean, we'll all get together at the nursing home and laugh about that quaint debate we had in Maine about laptops. Can you believe that we had that argument? Of course, by that time, all of the legislators that I'm in the nursing home with are going to say, yeah, we're with you all the way, Angus. we're there. Yeah, well, why was the vote 72 to 71, But of course it's going to happen. But Maine cannot lose this opportunity to continue to be first. And that gets, I got two endings. Unfortunately for you. One is that this is really urgently about the future of our children. We've got to equip these children with the skills and the tools to compete in this new flat world. If we don't, we have failed the most basic responsibility of parents, which is to give our children the skills and tools to survive. And as Friedman says, if we don't continually upgrade and drastically upgrade the skills of the American children right now, all they're going to have is lousy jobs. It's going to be no real opportunity, and our children are going to look to us and say, what did you do on the flat Earth, Daddy? Where were you when the Earth flattened and all our jobs went somewhere else? And we've got to be able to look them in the eye and say, we did something about it. We gave you the tools, or we worked to give you the tools. So that's why I think this is, I can't emphasize how important this is. Finally, Mary says I say finally too much, it gets people's hopes up. Finally, I'll leave you with something light and a little sort of funny. Oh, by the way, have you guys seen Tiger yet? Is Tiger here? Can I take Tiger home with me? Have you seen the new video conferencing thing on Tiger where you can put four people in and it's crystal clear? It's fabulous. I called Cupertino and tried to get an advance copy for a speech that I'm making tomorrow night at Bowdoin, and I don't think I'm going to get it because I wanted to demo it. Because I don't think most Americans don't have any idea what's coming at them. We're asleep. And they don't have any idea. And you show that my idea for my speech, which I'll tell you, which I'm not going to get to use, but was to have my friend Bruce Dixon in Australia, my son Angus in Portland, a friend in California, and do a four-way video conference right in the middle of the speech. That would wake them up in Brunswick, Maine. Unfortunately, Apple, God bless them, I love them. No, you can't have one a day early. I wish, if the speech were 2 days later, I wouldn't have asked to ask anybody's permission. I just would have done it. But anyway, I got my eyesight last week, so I'm ready for Tiger. Gus, go for it. Particularly if you've got an eyesight. I'm still in the stage where I want to play with it.
We're your people.
We're your people. Okay. Well, you've got to be the apostles. You've got to be the advocates. You've got to be the champions. And you can. I'll leave you with this cute thing. You may have heard me say this before. My two favorite philosophers, do you know this? Charles Darwin and Wayne Gretzky. You know about this? Darwin, survival of the fittest. And for all my life, I thought survival of the fittest meant the biggest, the strongest, longest teeth, big, strong arms, you know, for the best. That's what we all thought of. And I was having a conversation 4 or 5 years ago with somebody about this, and my friend said, no, no, that's not what he said. Go read Origin of the Species. And if you go and find the page where he talks about the survival of the fittest and defines the fittest, you know how he defines the fittest? Organizations, individuals, or organisms most adaptable to change. That's who survives. And we are living in the most accelerated period of change in human history. And if we're not adaptable to it in a hurry, well, you know what happened to the dodo? And then Wayne Gretzky. Gretzky, greatest hockey player in the history of the National Hockey League, scored more goals. He wasn't as big, wasn't as fast, but he had this amazing, uncanny knack for scoring goals. And one time a reporter said, Mr. Gretzky, how do you do this? How do you score all these goals? You're not so big, not so fast, but you do it. And Gretzky gave a great Canadian answer. Gretzky's a Canadian. I love Canadians. They're very direct, honest. I have a daughter-in-law who's a Canadian. She's from Toronto. By the way, you know the definition of a Canadian? A Canadian is an unarmed North American with health insurance. That's a Canadian, isn't it? Boy, did they love that line in New Brunswick. They loved it. So anyway, Gretzky, how do you score all the goals? Gretzky said a very profound thing. He said, it's easy. I skate to where the puck is going to be. Everyone else skates to where it is. That's amazing. I skate to where the puck is going to be. Everyone else skates to where it is. If we can skate to where the puck is going to be, and we know where it's going to be, we're going to win. But if we ignore where we know it's going to be, we're going to get slammed into the boards by 3 billion people from India and China. Tom Friedman says when he was a kid, and I remember my mother used to say this, eat your spinach, because there are millions of Chinese who want it. He now tells his girls, do your homework, there are millions of Chinese who want your job. That's today's version of the same deal, and it's absolutely true. I'll leave you with one little final fact. Last year in America, 37,000 people graduated with engineering degrees. In India, 275,000 graduated with engineering degrees. So, you know, that sort of says it all. Anyway, you're wonderful. Keep up the fight. I know the money has run out, but, you know, keep the faith. We've got to make this happen and continue to happen. And thank you for making it work so well. I should have said that at the very beginning, because it was your work and the work of the teachers who were receptive and willing to adapt and willing to change and willing to move in new directions that has made this the most successful educational technology project in the history of the world. And we just have to keep up the momentum on that. And I'm just proud to be associated with such a wonderful group of people. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andy. And we have a gift from Seed.
Oh, wow.
This is the Seed gift pack, the official version. The laptop bag, and there's some goodies in there.
Yeah,
thank you very
great.
Much.
I don't think it's a PowerBook.
No, I don't think.
And Angus, on behalf of Seed Statewide, this is from Southern Maine, on behalf of Seed Statewide, okay. It is black for a reason. We are over, but we'd like to confer on you the official seedling.
Oh, that's great.
We'll make it Angus an honorary seed.
A lot of food for thought there. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. It was great to hear it again. I haven't heard it in about a month. I'd love to hear your feedback for it, so please go to the website and leave some comments there or send email. You can visit us at bobsprankle.com/bitbybit. and send us email at bitbybitpodcast@gmail.com. If you'd rather, you can send audio comments and I can play them right on the podcast. My name's Bob Sprankle. This is Bit by Bit, and I hope to get another episode up soon. Thanks for listening.